Good morning. Sometimes it's good to ask the big questions, particularly in a slightly throwaway manner.
Does going to space make you more or less inclined to think there's a God?
Ah, Brendan, we're barely out of the bed. Go get your coffee, though. We're going in.
Whatever you believed beforehand is going to be deepened by the experience of leaving Earth. I don't know of anybody in the shuttle era or afterwards who's had a religious epiphany. But some of the guys who walked on the moon did, because they were so unprepared for what it was going to mean to them.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield with the God question, and we're not even a minute into the programme. Peak playback this week, I tell you. On you go.
Does it change you? Because, you know, we literally have a phrase in the English language, to come back down to Earth, right? When you come back down to Earth after doing something like that, that's so intense and a kind of a pinnacle of an existence, really, is anything else ever really the same or as important again?
Did you listen to William Shatner? You know, he was an actor and on Star Trek, but he flew on one of those little short tourist flights. He had an epiphany. It changed him. He's a grizzled 90-year-old tough actor guy, and he was shocked by his lack of previous understanding of what spaceflight was going to be like and the difference between our world and the rest of the universe. But as a professional astronaut, I'd been thinking about it since I was 9, and I'd been training about it for 26 years before my first spaceflight. So I was far more ready for it. And I think that process of training shaped me equally to the magnificence of the spaceflight itself. It reaffirmed a lot of the things that I'd prepared myself for. But I do see the world differently. I've been around the planet 2,650 times. I've seen all 8.2 billion people over and over and over again conducting their lives. I've seen the wicked, war-torn hotspots and then the tremendous preponderance of peaceful life on the planet. I've seen the age of the world. I've gone from one side of the sun to the other, watched the entire seasons of the world swap ends on the planet like it was taking a breath. And that's how I see the world every day. When I walk around the streets of Dublin, I'm seeing more than just, you know, the stone and the wet.
Chris Hadfield, and that interview in a week where there was a lot of focus on space travel or space tourism. Katy Perry, we'll get there. But let's continue to blow our little minds with the nature of the universe and our mere speck status in it. On Drive Time, astrophysicist Professor Brian Schmidt, and this was the research that had earned him a Nobel Prize. Swig your coffee.
So in 1998, I was the lead of a team that looked back in time with exploding stars called supernovae and measured how fast the universe was expanding back into time. So we started in a relatively nearby universe. So in this case, you know, maybe 100 million years ago. And then by looking further and further, we're looking back into time because the light takes time to reach us. Mm-hmm. And we were able to go through and do that same type of measurement of how fast the universe is expanding back to about 8 billion years into the past. And what we found was that the universe, which we expected to be slowing down due to the gravity of everything in the universe, was actually speeding up. And gravity seemed to be pushing the universe apart. And that was a big surprise. Mm-hmm. And so that is for what we won the Nobel Prize. And we think it means that the universe is full of energy. About 70% of the universe is stuff that is everywhere, but you can't really see except for by this effect.
An awful lot of people everybody will be impressed with your discovery, of course, and the level of research and so on. But some people might say, Professor, why do all this study about astrophysics and space? What does it do for me?
Inside voice, Cormac. Inside voice.
The foundational reason we do it is because we're interested, and humans have used astronomy, and kids have asked, what's going on? How come? That's what I said when I was about 3. Mm. You know, what's going on with stars? So we are, I think, innately interested. But governments fund it because it turns out to be very useful. And so when you look at your iPhone that I'm talking to you right now on, you know, all sorts of things in it come from astronomy, even though they weren't planned. The digital camera that we all use, well, that's from a Mission to Jupiter, the Wi-Fi, well, that comes from radio astronomy. The touchscreen comes from CERN, as does the World Wide Web. The GPS is actually tied to Einstein's theory of general relativity. So all of those things emerged out of something that seems useless. But that's kind of the beautiful thing of how research works. You don't just do what you know. You learn new things, and those create the revolution.
I feel that's us told. And then later in the week, the strongest evidence yet that we are not alone in the universe. Chemicals detected in a giant planet 124 light years from Earth. A very excited Kevin Nolan of TU Dublin joined Ray.
This is exciting, or is it?
It is. Oh, yeah. This is a very exciting discovery. Yeah. Yes, indeed. So what they've discovered is this material in the atmosphere of another planet called dimethyl sulfide, which is actually the smell of the sea or the smell of seaweed. It's made by phytoplankton on Earth. Now, phytoplankton are really important on Earth because they're at the bottom of the food chain. They make half our oxygen of the atmosphere. And even with this sulfur compound, regulate maybe cloud formation. We've discovered 1,000 times more of it on this planet.
Right. And where is this planet?
Now, it's 100 light years plus away, 124 light years away.
Will you try and explain that to people?
Yeah, it's very hard. So we're talking thousands of solar systems distance away. A light year is 10 trillion kilometres. So if the Voyager space probe was to get there, it would take maybe about 1 to 2 million years.
Ah, right.
Travelling at 17 kilometres a second. So... So we're not going there anytime soon.
No. But it's exciting because it's the eternal question, isn't it? Yeah. Is there other life forms out there?
Yeah. Now, we don't have to travel to these planets to analyse them. That's what James Webb is about. It can analyse the structure of atmospheres of planets that are thousands of light years away. So sophisticated are the instruments on it. And that's what's exciting about this. We couldn't do this before James Webb Space Telescope. And here we've asked the question of a planet. Might there be some biosignature evidence suggesting even microbial life? And this is the first time we've come up with an answer.
Its name, K2-18b.
So K2 is Kepler's probe that discovered its second mission and then the 18th star it looked at. And we name exoplanets A as the first discovered, B as the second discovered. We can't see it, but it's actually in the night sky tonight in the constellation of Leo.
So and it's in the solar system.
It has its own solar system. Two planets we know so far on this one. You know?
And its sun, is it smaller than our sun?
It's called a red dwarf, yeah. So in fact, this star planet is very close. But it's still in what we call the Goldilocks zone.
Yes.
Where it's not too hot, not too cold. You know? So that's why we believe there's liquid water there. And this biomarker, like, we don't know of any other process in nature that makes dimethyl sulfide other than phytoplankton. So this is we're very excited about it.
Wow, that is really cool. Kevin Nolan with Ray. And all of this in the week when space was becoming more and more accessible, assuming, of course, you had access to a well-connected billionaire. Back to Drive Time and astrophysicist Professor Brian Schmidt.
Can I ask you about the renewed fascination with space travel and colonizing Mars or traveling to space as a visitor? Perhaps it's because of Elon Musk and his enterprises or others. What do you make of it all?
You know, space had that first push in the 60s when it was all very new, and then it became very expensive. I mean, it was always expensive, but it was new. And so what I think Elon Musk, who is an interesting character, I think it's fair enough to say, he has really made good on the promise of getting things in space cheaply. And so space is interesting, but expensive. And if it suddenly becomes 10 or even 100 times cheaper to access, then there's all sorts of things you can do that are really exciting. And Starlink, where you create, you know, kind of Wi-Fi in the sky, is a good example. Even if it does screw up our telescopes a bit because of all the satellite trails and things that it makes.
Okay.
But I think it's that real ability to put things up en masse cheaply into space that's really revolutionizing things right now.
And it's happening more and more. We have an all-female crew, including pop star Katy Perry, today back on Earth after reaching space on Jeff Bezos' Blue Origin rocket, I think.
Can I ask? And for a slightly different take on Mr. Musk, we return to Chris Hadfield, the Canadian not holding back.
You worked with Elon Musk's SpaceX at one point. What do you think of him now?
SpaceX is leading the entire world in launch. They have developed, they've taken advantage of 60 years of NASA's work and other people's work to create an amazing launch capability that has dropped the cost of access to space and opened up space business like we've been dreaming of. It's
when
phenomenal.
When he uses his powers for good.
Well, you know, the thousands and thousands of people that work for SpaceX, you can pretend it's just one person. It is not, yeah, of course. And it's Gwynne Shotwell, a woman who runs SpaceX. But the incredibly bizarre and mercurial and at times horrific person, you know, has his name associated with it. Some of the things he's done recently are inexcusable.
He's insulted my
country and said things that I just find completely inexplicable and unforgivable. And
deal with him personally at the time?
No, I met him, but no, it's yeah. But people, you know, pretend that SpaceX is one person. It's like pretending the United States is one person or Russia is one person. It's easier for you to then make crass judgments, but it's wrong.
Interesting. But it was, of course, Amazon's billionaire Jeff Bezos who funded the all-female Blue Origin crew who went into space this week, among them Katy Perry. They went up, they had their 11-minute suborbital journey, they came back down. This was Katy Perry's reaction.
I feel super connected to love. So connected to love. I think this experience has shown me you never know how much love is inside of you, like how much love you have to give, mm-hmm, and how loved you are until the day you launch.
Oh, that's quite sweet, although it does risk leaving the rest of us who don't get to launch into space feeling a little shortchanged. Anyway. And while many were in awe of the project, many others were not. The cost both financially and also to the planet. On Morning Ireland, Audrey got this reaction from science educator Dr. Niamh Shaw.
What I think is great is, I mean, everybody's reacting to it very strongly, either in the positive or the negative. And that's exactly where we want to be. You know, we have this opportunity for people to see the Earth from a distance. And, you know, it's always going to be the wealthy and the celebrity and the star-studded who'll get that opportunity first. You know, we have a long way to go when it comes to where we're going as a society. And the more we can engage the public in those conversations, the better. So I'm not sure if it was Lauren Sanchez's plan to kind of get people talking about it. But I think it's fantastic that everybody has an opinion and everybody is aware that six women went to above the Karman line and officially went to space yesterday. That to me is a win because there's a lot of us that have been following space for a long time and you see lots of people go up and you go, this is it. This is the one that's going to help people understand that perspective of our place in space. And it doesn't. But this one, I think, has really shifted where the conversation is. So I'm excited, very excited.
From Morning Ireland on Tuesday. But it did not take too long for the backlash to really kick in. Fellow celebs taking down Katy Perry in particular. But was this fair? And does Katy even care? Here's Owen Murphy from the Communications Clinic on Drive Time.
What did you make of the backlash?
Well, what I make of the backlash and what Katy Perry think of the backlash are probably two very different things because for Katy Perry, it's what she's always craved, which is engagement, eyeballs on her, and it will generate content for her online. And I'd say she's absolutely delighted because she's been, I suppose, somewhat irrelevant for so long. And I think a lot of what she does is always to try and hype and build the hype around her. So I'd say she's absolutely thrill-cornered,
wow,
to be honest.
Wow, do you think so? So no news is bad news?
I think like this
or
is the woman
who turned bad news is good news still, I should say.
Yeah, this is somebody who turned up to the Met Gala dressed as a hamburger. You know, she knows exactly what she's doing. And at the end of the day, like if you want to bring it down to brass tacks, she got to go up in a very unique elite club that went to go up in zero gravity for 11 minutes in a ticket that cost, I think, in 2021, $28 million. So she gets the best of both worlds. And I think that even the entire production was designed to attract a specific audience. And I don't think the audience it was designed to attract are the people and the celebrities who are coming out and slamming them for it.
Quite the takedown of Katy. Cormac defended her.
We're dismissing her as kind of completely singular in her approach here. All she wants is engagement to promote herself, whereas she says it was in honour of Mother Nature and the power of women and the environment as well and exploration and discovery.
She also said she's going to put the ass into astronaut. So, you know, I'm not sure those statements live together. So I think she's very clever, and she does everything with her brand in sight. And I think she knew exactly what she was trying to achieve going up there. I think, like, as I said, it was designed to appeal to a specific audience, which is her 204 million followers who, you know, and she's in the business of, it's not so much social media as it's social engagement.
Okay.
Well, we'll leave that there, because meanwhile, over in Lyric, another two people were wondering, would we suit up?
Would you go, though?
I don't think I would, just not? In case anything would happen, or, yeah,
you know,
that I wouldn't come back.
Should we be lost? What would we do?
Do you remember the two that were up there for 9 months, not so long ago?
That's right. That'd be difficult. And you, as the fella said, and not even a change of clothes.
Yeah, you'd want to have somebody who's good company with you.
You would. You'd want someone you might get on. But it's just that... the day of, you'd be in the bed before you got out, and you'd be thinking to yourself, I wonder. Isn't it funny?
And
yeah, I was thinking that myself.
You know, could I get a sick day? You know, if anything, could I get a doctor's note if I really don't want to do this?
No, you can't get a sick day on the day of for something like that. There'd be no chance. But it was just that thing I just kind of thought, anyway, no, I just, because I think I'd be full of it until the day.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd be.
And those small spaces as well, that's what puts me off it. That's, you know, right. You're inside there with, who was it, Gail King, and there were a whole host of them.
That's right.
I saw them lining out. Six in total.
And the best thing you can do is float. That's all that's going to happen.
Yeah.
You're
going to
float. That's it. But you can do that. You can buy that down here, can't you?
Mm-hmm. great publicity for them, though.
Space tourism. I can see you now. The blue jumpsuit. Come on.
Line up.
We're going into space. It won't take long. You'll be able to go to the pictures later. It'd be grand. Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Oh, no. 7:48. She'd have to play David Bowie. You would. You truly would.
Love it. Back in a bit. Welcome back. Some acid brass from Turner Prize-winning artist Jeremy Deller. And for him, it is the music that means everything.
I think the way that music has changed my life and made my life a better place, I think that's the case for most people. So I think it's the way that music can transform people's lives, but also societies. And they can, so music can point the way forward and give you an idea about what society could be at its best. That's what I think about music.
And is it, to some extent, or to what extent, do you think that it's the absence, not always, but certainly a lot of the time, the absence of words that actually allows music to do that?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, when you think about, you know, I work with brass bands and steel bands, and I'm working with big bands here. There's no lyrics to the songs when they play them. And also a lot of dance music, the lyrical content is usually not that important. It's the sounds that are being created and what that does to people, how it affects people. So I think that is a very good point. It's not about lyrical content or language or anything like that, or different languages. It's just pure in a way, the way it gets to your brain.
Yeah, yeah, it kind of gets to places that you can't intellectualise about because there are no words. You know,
the only thing that really could get me to cry is music. No other art form do I cry in front of, not even cinema. It's music that does it for me.
Wow, yeah, music gets you at a very deep level.
Can't fight that one. Jeremy Deller with Sean on Arena. But if you had wanted to see grown men and women fall to their knees, gently weeping, you could have tuned in to Late Date in the early hours of a Monday morning when Ray Cudahy went live to Greg Allen at the US Masters in Augusta.
He is in the pantheon of the greats now, and the career arc, which has always had this moment of doubt, because was he ever going to be able to win the Masters? Was he ever going to have the nerve to close out the career Grand Slam? All those questions have reverberated around him since he won the USPGA Championship nearly 11 years ago. That was the third leg of the Grand Slam. This is the fourth leg. This is the final leg. And Rory McIlroy has won the Masters, and he will have the green jacket draped around him at the green jacket ceremony in the Butler Cabin here in Augusta very shortly. The words, Rory McIlroy is the champion in the 2025 Masters, is just a pleasure to actually be uttering here on the programme.
This is just absolutely immense, Greg. This is just absolutely everything in sport. This is the raw emotion, and it has the grandeur and the timelessness of it. This is one for eternity, and this is just such a moment in Irish sporting history.
Oh, and everyone was elated and emotional, not least our golf correspondent.
I've been doing this job for a long time, and this is one of the biggest stories I've ever covered.
And maybe it was because it had been so long in the making, so sought after and so elusive, that the victory, when it came, was very sweet.
Absolutely unreal. Absolutely unreal. Can't believe it.
He did put us through the ringer tonight, but he deserves it. He really deserves it. He has done the club proud.
Beyond epic. Just the unbelievable roller coaster.
And now, just trying to plan a big party to welcome him back home.
Oh, yes. Oh, my goodness. Oh, what a party that boy will get when he comes back home to Hollywood.
Oh, yes. See the rest of the week. Hollywood is going to be rocking.
McIlroy's hometown, courtesy of Vincent Kearney on Morning Ireland. And practically everyone had something in their eye on Monday morning.
I'm not crying, you're crying. Pádraig Harrington, good morning to you.
Good morning, how are you, Claire?
It was incredible. Absolutely incredible, wasn't it?
It's the most, well, sure, there's other sports drama, but it was certainly the most drama I've seen at golf. It was crazy stuff, the ebbs and flows in the last round. Even the very first hole, he looked like he'd lost it and Bryce was going to run away. And it just, yeah, you couldn't have expected so many of those turns.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't make it easy for himself or for us to watch it. But I suppose that added to the emotion that we all felt at the end.
Yeah, golf's a weird sport like that. It's very hard to hold the lead when you get defensive, especially for Rory. He's not a defensive player, and if you look at any of the mistakes he made in the last round was when he was being defensive. You know, when he gets aggressive, he hit some unbelievable shots coming home. So it's a very hard balance for golfers. I think that's what's kind of good about golf. It's exciting that it's very hard to win by a lot.
Yeah.
Also with Claire, Joe Malloy, host of the Indo Sport podcast, and like the Nation, he too was wrecked.
It's hard to think of too many outpourings like that on an 18th green, that level of emotion. You know, it was really, I mean, he was heaving initially when he fell to his knees. Nick Faldo, as you mentioned, said he would. He was heaving. You know, you could see his body. He couldn't breathe for about 5 minutes afterwards. You can't but watch the humanity of it when he sees his family and he's walking through the crowd. I feel like he was short for breath. You can't overstate the extent to which this has been an odyssey for Rory for 14 years since he should have won this tournament in 11 and has had so many trials and tribulations. There was a point where he was in control of the tournament halfway through, and I thought to myself, oh, this feels a bit anticlimactic. Like, I feel if Rory's going to win the Grand Slam, it should be, you know, drama to the end. And, I mean, yeah. I was then cursing myself several moments later. That was...
Oh, peak birdie bogey drama. And for golf commentator Shane O'Donoghue on the News at One, it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy.
He's adored. I mean, he's just box office. And I know that sounds corny when he's from Hollywood to be box office, but he is. He's just got that attractive appeal. And, you know, golf a lot of the times is like life. You've got your ups and you've got your downs. You've got your successes. You've got your failures. How do you deal with adversity? We saw every bit of it played out in the final round yesterday as he carried a two-shot lead into the Masters tournament. The one event that was missing from his incredible resume. And he put us through the ringer watching him yesterday, but it was worth the watch. It was full of drama. And, you know, that's Rory. It can be amazing. Sometimes it can be frustrating. Sometimes it can be disappointing. But he's an absolute born winner.
And what of the man himself? After so many years, was it possible to put into words what it all meant? Greg Allen on Morning Ireland brought us this.
On 18, you collapsed to the ground. The relief was palpable. The joy was somewhat unfolding after the relief. For you, what does it mean to have taken this burden off your shoulders, because everybody has followed your story?
I can certainly drive down Magnolia Lane a little more free next year. Just the knowing that I'm able to come back here each and every year. I've got the Grand Slam monkey off my back. I've got the, you know, when's Rory going to win his next major off? You know, all of that is gone, which is so nice to be able to turn up to these big events and not have to answer those questions, not have to go through that anymore. And honestly, you know, with the way I'm playing, the way I'm feeling about my game, you know, I feel like this could be the start of some really good things.
An amazing achievement. Meanwhile, with the Darcy, a one-woman show.
It's just you and there's nowhere to hide. It's you, a bag, a bench and a bottle.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. There's no fluff. There's no set. There's no, you know, there's no fluff at all. There's no sound cues other than at the end, which I won't give the game away, but there is one at the end. But it is, there's nowhere to hide.
It's you. It's you.
It's just me.
That's Fiona Hewitt-Twomley. The play, Myra's Story, written and directed by Brian Foster. And when she says it's a one-woman play, she ain't lying.
45 pages of script.
Yeah.
16 characters. I'm just going to repeat that for people at home because they probably may not have heard that. And some of the characters are children, some of the characters are men.
Yeah, the majority of the characters are actually male. You can probably hear on the radio that I have quite a deep sound to my voice.
And you can go deeper, can't you?
I can go as deep as you like, right?
Whoa! Like that, they've heard a lot, Fiona. Dave has heard an awful lot. Now that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's easy.
It's easy. Yeah.
No, because people could probably, you know, build up to that, but you just like that.
On stage, there's an argument that goes on between two males and a female, and it's a quick argument. So I have to be able to be quick to transition from male to female, from female back to male, and different accents.
Did Brian know you could do this?
No. Brian asked me what I thought of the play. I told him I thought it was amazing and I thought there was loads I could do with it. Mm. And he said, like, and I said, well, the 16 characters, I can give them all different physicalities, different shapes, different voices, different sounds and different accents. And he said, impossible. And I said, not. And I did it there and then from In the Eye to Eye. And it wasn't very long. I think I was still on my way home and I got a call to say, you've landed. Yeah. It's definitely your gig.
Oh, it most certainly is. Once more, just in case you missed it.
I can go as deep as you like, right?
Now that, my friends, is a gift. Fiona Hewitt-Twomley in Myra's Story, coming to the Gaiety Theatre soon. On Liveline, why go bald? Why indeed? Unless, of course, you want to. It all started with Brendan, who had had a shaving malfunction, scabby head, but it opened up a whole conversation few of us were fully prepared for.
When you're rubbing your hand over your bald head, your shaved head, are you looking for complete snooker bald smoothness, or would you live with stubble?
Oh no, smooth if you can.
Okay.
And they were off.
John Horan in Clondalkin, and put your hand to your head.
Yeah, right, John, yeah.
And what are we feeling?
Oh, super sexy.
Noel Manning, Noel Manning, put your hand to your head, and what are we feeling?
Oh, smooth.
Oh, God.
Smooth, Joe. The women love bald snooker heads, boy.
Are you
serious?
They
absolutely love it.
And what, they just,
100%, yeah.
They just about just love caressing it.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. But I have to say, like, even if I didn't shave no for about 3 days, it feels like a dirty mat on your head, the stubble.
Yeah.
And I just have to get it off, like. And when you have a wet shave then and you put on the aloe vera, I tell you something, boy, it's incredible.
Noel, do you care to comment on the survey that Michael Roach of Cork has done, where he believes his beautifully snooker ball smooth head is more appreciated by members of the opposite sex?
Oh, I would think so, yeah.
Would
my
you?
Wife
okay.
loves it, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Joe went in for a bit of a probe.
And Michael, is that a survey you did below in Cork, or just, is this anecdotal?
No.
Okay.
No, I in Kenya, you know, the majority of women, they love a bald head. They won't tell you, but you know, if you're talking to them, by they're lamping the top of your head, okay. And they're shining on your head is the better part.
Oh, beautiful.
And yet, curiously silent, but Michael, very confident.
I think I have a very good bald head for a bald head.
Only a Cork man. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On the History Show, we started at the very beginning, our fossils. Here's Maria McNamara, Professor of Paleontology at UCC.
Now, most of these fossils are from a time before the dinosaurs. Ireland, to put it mildly, was a very, very different place then, wasn't it?
It was. I mean, during the Carboniferous period, where most of Ireland's fossils are from, Ireland was actually located in the southern hemisphere. So we were 10 degrees south of the equator. In terms of what that means, that's like the Bahamas. It was fabulous. It was warm. There was a shallow, warm sea, lots teeming with life. I mean, it was fabulous, really. And, you know, we see the life forms, all of the animals that lived in that shallow sea, we now see preserved in the limestones that underlie about 70% of this country. So we have tropical corals. We have tropical shellfish, such as clams. We've got tropical sea snails. We've got tropical fish and trilobites, little woodlouse-like creatures. We've got remains of all of these preserved in our rocks.
That's kind of cool. And UCC want you to get involved in their Great Fossil Hunt of Ireland and help them map all the fossils on the island. And while you can find fossils in lots of places, exposed limestone at the beach or on mountains, you might also find them here.
The great news is you can find lots of Irish fossils in the building stones that are used in our villages and our towns and our cities. So that grey stone you might see on the footpath or in the gutter or on a wall, that's almost certainly our Irish limestone. And it is jam-packed full of fossils. So we run fossil walks in towns around the country where we show people, look, this is what you can find in the wall of the bank, on the floor of the shopping centre. So you can find fossils literally on your way to get a pint of milk.
Putting it up to us, and McNamara is on a mission to get us to rethink everything we thought we knew about rocks and their value.
Here in Ireland, I guess, you know, we have a legacy of, you know, viewing rocks as commodities, as something to use to build the wall in the garden, to dig up to make a bit of space. But it's time we change that narrative and that we actually really start viewing, you know, the rocks as what they really are, which is part of our natural heritage. They're part of our history, history that goes back a long way, but heritage nonetheless. And the fossils are really important because they tell us where we've come from. They tell us what Ireland, what this country was like in the past, before humans got here. So I actually see fossils as really critical, a really critical connection for Irish people to the land going back millions of years.
And when she says millions of years, she's not exaggerating. Ireland boasts some of the oldest in the world. Take a bow, Valentia.
We have fossils going back almost to the dawn of animal life. We have fossils dating back to 540 million years ago. So that's really when animals, multicellular creatures like us, were evolving. And we have some of the first evidence of early animals exposed here in Ireland on the rocks on Bray Head in County Wicklow. And we've got some other fossils which are globally important. So one of those would be the Valentia tetrapod trackway. So that is a series of footprints that was made by a giant salamander as it walked on the wet mud at the side of an ancient river over 400 million years ago. So, and those are the earliest accepted footprints made by a land animal ever, anywhere on the planet. There are some footprints that are a few million years older in Poland, but they're very controversial. So our ones, our examples, the Valentia trackway, that is the oldest trackway made by a land animal. So that's amazing that we've got it right here in Ireland. And we also have evidence of the sort of the very oldest plants that grew on land that are from the Silurian period, about 440 million years ago. So we have fossils here in Ireland that are actually important on a global scale. And, you know, we think that people should know about this and we should be proud of this.
Fascinating stuff, Professor Maria McNamara on The History Show. And with Oliver, historian Joe Kerrigan, and something ancient but of a different sort. Can you guess what they're talking about?
You'd need to know where you're, where to look, wouldn't you?
You'd need to be standing on a high hill or using a drone and you suddenly realise that there are three or four or five in the valley below you. And that's where you start asking the question, hang on a minute, how come there are so many of them left? And that's the important thing.
That's the question.
And the answer? Fairy forts. And Kerrigan has written a book called Irish Fairy Forts, Portals to the Past. And they're circular for a reason.
We were always circular. It's how we represent everything.
Mm.
The squares and angles and hard corners come from a Roman time. They come from a later time in other countries. If you even find old, if you find a really old graveyard here, it'll be circular.
Really?
Yes, our stones, Brúna Boyne and Newgrange, you know, all of the old ancient sites that we have around Ireland, they're all circular as well. It's the magic circle. It's like you get in Wicca or the other pagan. Anyone who practices a pagan religion will know that you have the circle. You make the circle of power. You stand inside a circle to protect yourself, or you put a circle around something to keep it safe.
And this tells us why they have so much power.
What do we believe is going on at these fairy forts? What it's an entry to the other world.
It's an entry to the other world, to themselves. It's their fort, because our tradition is that when the Celts came to Ireland, they drove the Tuatha De Danann, the fairy folk, underground.
Yes. Oh, yes.
And that they stayed there. Some say they played a trick on them for doing it by they saying, look, we'll take Ireland half and you have half. And the Tuatha De Danann, who were believed in good things, said, yes, OK, we'll do that. But they tricked them. They said, you can have the half under the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But their suzerains underneath, and they believed that this takes you into the fairy world, the other world. And if you do go in there, you might not get back.
Ooh, and now we're getting into the scary, because only a fool, a crazy fool, would mess with the fairy fort.
Richard Lundy, he was a wealthy Lundy, man yeah. living in Ardnagh, and he knocked down the fort. He was told not to, people told not to, but he did it. And while he was actually working at it, directing his workmen, his two horses that were pulling the gear for him dropped dead. And then his daughter lost her sight. She went blind.
Oh, my God.
And I think and all his stock died that year. All the animals he had on his farm died that year. And the story I got that from the school's collection, says shortly after, the name of Lundy was not in Ardnagh. The name of Lundy was gone forever. They disappeared. Oh, there's more in Monaghan. Crikey, there's a fort where pass it at night, there's a cat, a huge black cat comes out and attacks you. And it won't let you out of the area until you go away. And there's another place in Monaghan, it's just a place I'm mentioning because they got them all over Ireland, where they used to pull out, the people lived in a house near to the fairy fort, and the fairies would come in at night and use their sewing machine.
Right, okay.
They'd pull out the old treadle sewing machine in the middle of the floor.
Destroy
and you'd hear that machine going. It's like that one in County Cork I knew, my father told me of, some friends of his, the twins, the Conran twins. They had a poltergeist in their house because they were near the fairy fort, and he used to come out and turn the handle of the mangle. You won't know what a mangle is.
No, go on, tell us.
It's what you used before you had these modern washer dryers.
Squeezing out the clothes.
Yeah, you'd squeeze the clothes through it and you'd turn a handle and the sheets would be dry. Would you take a lot of the water out of the sheets? Well, they used to hear this at night, turning away in the kitchen, the bangle going crangle, grangle,
oh,
grangle.
I can't imagine that.
Yeah. Ooh, and if you're out there raised eyebrow with your smartphone, please, we're in the age of AI. We give you this.
Even people who say they don't believe in any of this rubbish and any of this nonsense, they say, but I do know one thing. I would never touch a fairy fort.
Wouldn't dare.
Down near here near Ringaskiddy, we've got a huge number of pharmaceutical and other industrial companies.
Yeah.
And yet in the middle, there's a tiny field with a ring fort in the middle of it, right in the middle of it. Mm. And no one dares touch it.
Ooh, sound of spooky fairies. And even Jo and her husband, photographer Richard Mills, had encountered mischief.
And we went around it. We were careful enough not to go in. And we went around the edges and said, right, we'll get a picture here, we'll get a picture there. And all Richard's camera batteries went dead. And we said, come on, Richard, you usually charge me. He said, I always charge them. They are never wrong.
And his spares.
Yeah, and his spares in the bag were completely dead. So we went back to the car thinking, what the heck is going on here? And the car wouldn't start. And now, look, he's used to driving. We tried everything. We tried this, we tried that, we tried the other. We went round to the back, went to the front. We undid things, we put them back. And it would not start. So we rang the AA and they said, well, it'll be at least 2 hours where you are. And while we were waiting, several farmers passed us in their tractors. And as they would do, they stopped to ask you, they do down there, mm-hmm. Can we help? Can we do anything to help? And when we told them what had happened, they all said the same thing. Well, what do you expect when you're annoying themselves?
With themselves.
You'd never call them the fairies. You'd always say themselves or the good people or the other people or the other crowd, I think somebody calls it.
The other crowd?
Yes, Eddie Lennon, the folklorist, calls them the other crowd.
Yeah.
Whoops, bit late now. Joe Kerrigan with Oliver. But bringing us right back into reality with a bucket of cold water, personal finance expert Owen McGee. He had the ledger out for Gen Z. Rein it in, you 20-somethings, lest you pay in later life. And he uttered the words that really, well, no one ever wants to hear.
You have to cut your cloth because you can enjoy it today and have problems later, or you can adjust today and live a better standard of living all the way through your life.
And you don't want to see under 28s, under 30s having car loans, do you?
Or absolutely not. No. And you know what else I would say to you, particularly as you're coming through and you're coming up in your career and you're starting to make money and you're watching people maybe around the office or your peers, your colleagues, and even your mates going off buying cars, right? Cars is one of those things where we look at them and we say, how is that person managing to do that? How do they have that money? And I know what they do for a living. They're in a similar job to me. They're going on holidays and they're doing. Remember when you see a car, it's not, don't say to yourself, that's a lovely new car. Say, that's a lovely new car loan. Because that's what it is. Figures would suggest it's about 85% of new cars in Ireland are financed in some way, whether mm-hmm. that's PCP or hire purchase or other loans. So it's not a new car, it's a new loan they have.
Yeah, I heard you saying that before and it changed my whole perspective on cars.
Great!
Absolutely. And of course, it is sound advice. No one can doubt it. But still.
A 25-year-old today sits down, two mates, right? Let's call them Salt and Pepper because we mentioned how to be good at money,
you
right?
Love salt and pepper.
Salt and Pepper sit down, they're two mates, and they both decide, I want to have $1 million in my pension pot when I retire. Pepper says, I'm going to start today. Sits down with a financial advisor and gets advice and is told, yeah, you need to put €500 a month into that. And Salt says, oh, I'll do it next year, and then next year, and then next year. And Salt wakes up on their 35th birthday and says, I want the same €1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And they sit down with an advisor. They need to put €1,000 a month in, twice as much as Pepper did. Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you say Salt and Pepper? Juvenile. And yet that is it from this week's playback. Thank you for listening. Talk to you next week.